A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
What most people think.
Hello and welcome to episode 9 of What Most People Think. How are you? You alright? Yeah, you had any big nights out recently? Yeah, you've been out doing some Chang with Gove, yeah, smoking crack with Rory Stewart hitting the rocks. I love politics at the moment. You've got to be honest, like, whatever view you have on left or right or Brexit or whatever, but it is massively fucking entertaining. But we will get into that in a sec. Yeah, this is episode 9 of What Most People Think. If you haven't listened to the show before, it's a comedy discussion slash political show that's coming at it from, you know, not exactly the woke end of things, you know, not seeking to cause offence, but equally not worrying too much if offence happens, if you get my drift. And I've got today on the show, we had Ramesh Ranganathan on last time. Thank you so much for all the feedback about that. We've got Simon Evans on today. Simon is proper clever. Okay, so if you hear in this podcast just a silence of like a brain ticking over and trying to keep up, that is definitely, you are hearing that properly coming off my head, just trying to keep up with some of the things that Simon says. He's an incredibly bright man. So, you know, if you're like me, one of the things about podcasts is every once in a while you like to listen to one that might make you feel a bit more clever. And certainly after I was with Simon, I felt a bit brighter, briefly. And then, you know, when I watched the film, when I watched Godzilla, King of the Monsters, just to restore normal order. But let's just get briefly into, before we get into the chat with Simon, because it's a good long chat, this one. I think it's going to be Boris. Do you know what I mean? It seems inevitable that Boris Johnson is going to lead the Conservative Party. And I've never been, you know, I've always thought that Boris was kind of like a luxury player. If it was football, you know, he'd be the guy that you bring on, you know, when you're 4-0 up just to do some back heels, nutmegs, and, you know, essentially entertain the fans. But the problem is that the others have got such clear flaws. You know, I don't think Jeremy Hunt's necessarily the guy. I think Jeremy Hunt is like that guy, you know, you work with somebody and you think, how the fuck has he got so many promotions? You know what I mean? Like when it's not like he's without talent, but you just wonder, it's almost inspirational to a degree that you think, wow, if Jeremy Hunt can hold two of the highest states of office for a prolonged period of time. I mean, Jeremy Hunt is like the political equivalent of, you know that song, when if the Nevilles play for England, so can I. That's who he is. That's who he is. And the other day, he was talking about abortion as well. And I know that in this Tory leadership candidate race, everyone's got to have their USP. You know, I'm a crackhead. You know, I love the Charlie. I love the weed. Jeremy Hunt, I think he didn't bring enough drugs game to the table. So he's gone, I'm going to throw some abortion into the mix. You know, having a USP is great, Jeremy, but find a better one would be my advice. Sajid Javid, he calls himself the Saj. I've got to be honest, I'm slightly suspicious of any man that decides on his own nickname. Okay, you don't get to decide your own nickname. That's one of the rules about nicknames. It's not for you to decide. And the Saj. And the power stance, I mean, this boy takes himself quite seriously, Sajid, doesn't he? And then you've got Sam Gimia. What the fuck is he doing in this leadership race at all? The idea that at this point, right, that the Tories could have a Remain leader after everything that's happened with Theresa is just ridiculous. I think so far two Tory MPs have come out and supported him. And I've sort of, you get to the point with some of these leadership candidates, certainly with Sam Gimia, you say, well, why are you doing it, mate? And then I wondered, he's like, maybe it's just like something good to have in your CV, isn't it? Like, you know, doing the Duke of Edinburgh award scheme. Just, it's good to say that you did it, right? You know, just like, you know, 2019, for 2 weeks, I was in the running. You weren't in the running, Sam. Yeah? you were in the running. I could enter the marathon, mate. Okay, it doesn't mean that I was ever going to win the marathon. So just please drop out. By the way, sorry for there's a little bit of background noise there. You're thinking, Jeff, it sounds like you're in a sort of meeting room. And in an adjacent meeting room, a lot of women have showed up with their kids and there's noise coming from that. That is exactly what has happened. But, you know, what, you're saying that women aren't allowed to bring their kids into work and stuff? What is fucking wrong with you? Okay, so apologies if that background noise has been annoying you. But what, you're annoyed by children? We've got to repopulate the planet. Fucking Scrooge. Before we crack on, just a thank you and a fuck you. Thank you to the people of Cardiff. I went there for the Sri Lanka, New Zealand cricket match in the World Cup the other day. And Cardiff is, it's a good night out. It is raw as a night out. Cardiff's one of those places, it's a bit like, you know, the Northwest, where you just get grandparents out drinking with their grandkids. It's just weird. Do you know what I mean? There's no age boundaries in Cardiff. It can make for some weird sights on the dance floor. Do you know what I mean? I'm just going to say that if you were into your gilfs, I saw some things in retro that no one. I just realised the irony of that. I was in a place called Retro, and I saw a lad that was snogging a woman that could legally and biologically have been his grandma. So that's pretty bleak. I shouldn't have told you that. But enjoyed it. It's all part of the rich tapestry of a beery night out in Cardiff. And then also I saw. Well, fuck you to the Sri Lanka cricket team. I'll tell you what, you pricks. If we're going to go all the effort to get out to Cardiff on a Saturday and then just turn in, you waft. It didn't even last as long as a 2020 match. It was this horrible feeling that we had where I just realised I wasn't going to be able to be drunk enough. You know, you ever get that feeling? We were doing shots before lunch because it was kind of like... It was kind of like what I'd imagine, you know, if society ever had a nuclear warning where you just go, fuck, this is going to be over really soon. So you just had geezers running to the bar, just getting as drunk as they could, just eating as many burgers as they could, trying to compact what would be a full day's worth of cricket into literally a couple of hours. But like I said, luckily the city of Cardiff, as it always does, made up for that. This is going to sound like a really cheeky tour plug, but I am going to be in the city of Cardiff at the Glee Club on my tour, so do check out my Twitter or Live Nation for any of the details of those tickets. Now we're going to get on with a chat with Simon. I'll just be back with a little plug halfway through, but I hope you enjoy the chat with the one and only Simon Evans. So, on the show, I have Simon Evans today. Simon, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Very welcome, Jeff.
I thought it would be interesting to have you on the show because you're another one of those comics that your political orientation is interesting. It's not conventional in any sense. I know this feels like...
Not the libtard orthodoxy.
Exactly, yeah. Fucking libtards and their soy lattes, right?
Yeah.
So I can remember, like, I watched, like, one of the first times I saw... You do comedy, and this was so unusual at the time. As you came out and you did that joke, I hope you don't mind me sort of butchering the joke, but you alluded to your own accent,
yeah,
and then you pointed out that you were educated.
It was educated,
and you owned that fact, and I really remember that because I hadn't seen anyone. Everyone was always apologetic about sort of class or yeah. being intelligent and all that sort of stuff, and you went out and owned it.
It's interesting how that came about, interesting to me anyway, but it was, like with most of my comedy, it is much more trial and error than it's tempting to take credit, you know, to take some sort of credit for that. But I think it was in Southampton Jonglers, and it was John, what was his name? This is terrible. Now, this will happen dozens of times, Bob, but fairly sort of shambolic compare from Essex, from used to run the Harlow.
There's a few of those.
You know, anyway, he basically, yeah, it was old Jupiter's his mate who'd been sort of talked into doing the comedy.
Oh, good old John Mann.
Lovely guy. And I did that line, I think almost like as a throwaway line. I think it was almost ad-libbed on the night. You know, maybe not exactly, but it occurred to me in the dressing room or something. Or maybe it might actually have been something I responded to somebody going, oh, listen to him, you know, like that. And he went, that's a good line, you should keep that. And it became my sort of signature opening line, you know, for years.
So, is it all right if I quote the line now, just in case people...
You may be struggling. Well, the thing that went nicely with it was it would start a cascade. I always think with stand-up, the key is to start a cascade of laughs.
Yes,
you don't just want banging out.
Yeah.
You want to be like, you want to penetrate an organ that then hemorrhages and fills, you know what I mean?
I love
it's
that.
Like, yeah.
yeah.
So it's like you may be struggling to place my accent. It is, in fact, educated. Not expensively. I just paid attention, that's all. But it was that was a little afterthought which came out of guilt because I wasn't privately educated. But then I go... I use that line in Newcastle recently, and well, they were fine about it at first. Then one of them got it, passed it around, things turned a bit ugly, and it all became this kind of sort of sequence of events, you know, like the tussles I'd had.
Yeah,
from
I love
it,
comedy
you know.
Like that, because what you're doing, I think, is giving credit. You know, one, you know, there's an element of personal responsibility that comes in that, as you know, yes. I paid attention, and it just stylistically, comedy can tend towards like certain rules about punching up, punching down. I think that's way less clear than people make out that it is.
Absolutely agree with you. Yeah.
But in that case, you're sticking it to the plebs a little bit. But
in the
funny.
Course of the run, you know, in the course of a routine, the status should shift back and forth frequently. You know, this is what I always think. You start taking a joke out of somebody, and then and then you how it's come back on you, and how you've ended up, you know, in dire straits for having pushed your it should swing back and forth, not be clear. You shouldn't be punching up or down in relentlessly.
Punching around the clock.
Fight should swing back and forth like a good boxing match at the end of a movie. You know, you think he's on his feet and he's on his ass and then he's on his feet again. And but in terms of my actual accent, I mean, I honestly don't know that it is that posh. I think I enunciate maybe a little bit more than,
just
you know,
being opposite me is going to make you sound more posh in a sort of relative coefficient. You're just for the record, Simon is a blanket middle of the road, but right now you sound like Landon Gentry. But you're not. It's just you're sitting opposite me.
No, I genuinely grew up in St Albans. We were in a little 3-bedroom semi, but we were opposite council houses. You know, it was not in a
dangerously close.
Like right opposite. Not only was it dangerously close, but they had more money. They had disposable income because they were all exactly the same sort of people, and I was in the same school with them, and they'd have the big tellies before us and all the rest of it. So, you know, there was genuinely that kind of distressed lower middle class kind of, just holding on with our fingernails. But I think my dad did perhaps emphasise that, given that he couldn't afford to have me educated in that sense, you know, to learn to speak well was one of those ways that you could bluff your way in the world with a certain amount of that. So maybe I did pick that up off him. I don't know. But
But, you know, people talk about where you are on the political dial. Yeah. And, you know, I think sometimes it's more inherent than you think. Because I can remember even being an 11-year-old.
Oh, I don't believe
this idea. This idea that, like, we were dependent on the state, inverted commas. What's the state? I don't want to be dependent on something that I don't really understand.
And could be taken away from you at the next election, sort of thing.
Well, I mean, you know, as we stand, very, you know.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, we were never dependent on the state. My dad was in employment until I was at university, and then he lost his job in his mid-50s, and he never worked again. He was put on a sort of, I suppose you might call it, I don't think it was a disability pension, but essentially he was a bit too emotionally bruised by that experience for a while, and then he basically, you know, ran it out. You know, it's like running down the clock, isn't it, at the end of the match?
There's probably a point that really bothered him, and then he started to not give a shit at all.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it was the best. I mean, it honestly was the best years of their life. But I mean, this is a massive issue for the country now, which I don't want to sound a hypocrite on the level of. But the reality is, my dad went away. He left school at 14, right, and went straight to work. Did a bit of national service later, but that was basically him in work from then until 56. So that's 40 years, right? Basically, he was in employment. He's now 89. He's spent 33 years, you know, retired. Yeah, yeah. You know. And I mean, he's had a great time, you know, most of it. He's slowing down now, finally, but he's done all sorts of hobbies. He's had a kiln, he's had a wood turning lathe, he's got a great garden that he's taken care of for most of his time, and all that is marvellous. But he's been economically unproductive for 33 years.
He's getting back,
do you know what
out
I mean?
There. It's high time
it's
you're
like,
on.
Yeah, man. I don't know what he's
put in a fucking shift.
Must be able to steam some stamps off envelopes or something, mustn't they?
Well, there is that weird generation of pensioners. And I'm always become conscious that the baby boomers are just getting almost a cliched level kicking now. But it's very possible that you'll have people soon that will have spent longer earning money in retirement than they did working.
Yeah. Well, if it hadn't been for him leaving school at such an absurdly early age, that would be my dad already. If he'd managed to get to the end of A-levels and he was mentally equipped to, you know, he was living with foster parents at that time and they got tired of feeding him. They wanted to see some sort of economic activity, basically. But but you know, that would be him now. He would have that seesaw would have tilted the other way.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, one of the things I find difficult to express at the moment is that I am patriotic, right? And that, because of, you know, certain elements of the Remain community, that's been then lumped in and confused with nationalism, which has then been equated directly with racism and stuff. And there, I think there are crucial distinctions between these things. And for me, patriotism is just I think this is a really good country to live in, right? So I, for whatever reason, got lucky enough to be born in a place that's pretty safe and is, you know, one of the top 5 or 6 economies in the world. It's very tolerant and socially liberal. So when I'm waving the flag, do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not waving it for fucking wars that I wasn't a part of. You know, I respect what my granddad achieved. but essentially I'm saying, yeah, cheers. So in a way I see it as sort of like, you know, it's not...
It's more like gratitude than pride,
isn't it? Do
you
know what? And it's something that the left should intrinsically like. I'm acknowledging my privilege. Isn't it? They love all that.
Yeah, they do. And but they don't like to acknowledge the superiority of the culture that they grow up in. No people in the left like that. I mean, that's almost the defining trait of the left, refusing to acknowledge that you may have emerged yourself with your ability to critique your own culture. Maybe, that may be the symptom of the fact that you live in a good one. You know, this goes, Orwell is the most famous one probably for identifying, you know, the leftist intellectuals, and they would rather be caught stealing money from the portrait in the church than they would, you know, saluting the flag.
But what is that? I think that's dominant at the moment. There is this kind of, I don't know if the word is the right word, but orientalism. When people look and they think, well, everyone in Italy is so sophisticated, everyone in South America. So, and you think, no, the thing is, I think there's just pricks everywhere. You know, we have the same proportion of pricks
here. You see people like Elton John in Italy apologising to the Italians who feel so ashamed for Brexit, apparently oblivious as to who they've elected in the last few years or the direction their politics is going in.
That's what I don't understand.
Salvini is to the right of Nigel Farage, you know, or certainly to the nationalist right.
I mean, all these countries have got, maybe I think that, you know, if it might be that Brexit is part of a populist surge. I think ours is a bit further down the road than other European countries, but I don't think that it will be the last. And I found that, you know, as odd as it is, like, racism is a bizarre thing, but equally to just despise the country that you live in and not be able to see what's good about it, that's also weird.
It's difficult. It's an interesting question what nationalism really is. I mean, people talk about this civic nationalism or ethnic nationalism. The word nation has changed its meaning over the years or is used differently. If you read any book written before the Second World War, certainly if you read a book like, say, Hilaire Belloc or someone like that discussing, you know, the do you know Belloc? He's like a Catholic writer, but he's most famous for writing sort of amusing Roald Dahl style children's nursery rhymes. But
it sounds
he
about my level, sort of more so politics I might as well. Get into that. Yeah. What's his name?
Belloc, Belloc.
See, the good thing about that is if it's understandable, but I can, when I say it to my mates, it will still sound clever.
Yeah.
I've been reading a lot of Belloc.
Yeah, should read some Belloc, mate.
Yeah.
Billy Belloc.
Belloc is the bollocks.
Chesterton would be another one. Those kind of era people anyway. But they will use the word nation completely without any sort of hesitation or need to explain it, meaning the people. They don't mean it. So they will speak of Israel, which didn't exist as a nation, meaning the Jewish people. They will call that Israel. And that's a way you use that to discuss the nation, because it's a people. They would never think that the nation is defined by its borders. The borders come and go, but the people is the nation. Mm. Nowadays, we're much more instinctively use the word nation to describe France, with no regard whatsoever of what might be the shifting ethnic makeup of France. Yeah. And so these kind of conversations get slightly confused as to exactly what it is and what you mean. Mm. Civic nationalism, I think, is broadly, most people would understand as being a much more sort of palatable and acceptable version of nationalism, you know, but even then you might, I mean, and probably that's what Nigel Farage would say he has sort of, whereas ethnic nationalism then quickly sort of gets into, you know,
much
ethnic
murkier
cleansing or whatever, you know, and the horrors. But that word still carries that taint from before the Second World War, when if you use the word nationalism, you were essentially speaking of ethnic nationalism. Mm. That was the default meaning. Do you see what I mean? So the same word is used now to taint a certain kind of political belief now, with a word that has changed its meaning dramatically over that period of time.
Is it? Can we define the difference? Patriotism is thinking you live in a good country. Nationalism is thinking you live in a better country. And that everyone else needs to...
What is it with patriotism? I mean, it comes from father, doesn't it? It's the fatherland. So, you know, that's it's the same route. So it's probably worse, if anything.
See, they're right. I was always going to end up at this point.
I don't know. I think wanting your country to be, you know, to have the right to self-determination and to defend its traditions and to not feel guilt or, you know, be constantly subjected to excoriating self-investigation, you know, and that's perfectly reasonable. If that's patriotism, I think that's fine. after all, we do have the Olympics and the World Cup every, you know, 4 years in rotation. It's that's a meaningless event if you don't feel any kind of desire to see your country do well, even though, of course, you know, a lot of the medals and games are won by people to whom ethnic nationalism would make, you know, make that a nonsense now.
On that subject, I mean, when it came, I remember there was an article that you wrote on Brexit. Now, yeah. I can't remember how you actually voted. Did you?
The truth is, on the day I didn't vote, because I was stuck in London, and unexpectedly I stayed over the night before, and I had a corporate up in Tower Bridge, and then I woke up in a hotel the day after Brexit again. Yeah. Thinking, oh well, that was fun. Turned on the TV and I remember seeing that red banner across the screen, and I could almost feel the entire city of London just sort of wobbling slightly. My instincts were, I was less certain, but I think I was hold my nose and vote Remain, if I'm honest. But I never felt any great enthusiasm for the EU. But like most people, I think I had not given it anything like as much thought beforehand.
That's quite a rational position, is to just be like a reluctant leave. Because I was I was a moderate leaver, and I haven't gone, I've never really gone full WTO, you know. I can't, it's sexy, the idea appeals to me. Like if you know, like there's a new way of labelling things, like in a very simplistic way. I mean, that's the fuck it Brexit, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it, you know, if somebody says, Jeff, do you want to give the EU a massive kick in the balls, even though your balls may hurt more, but for the satisfaction of seeing their balls swell up, I might take it, right? But that's not necessarily the right human reaction.
The question is, what would replace it? It feels like, as you say, a sort of almost gladiatorial position, doesn't it? It's stripped down.
It's almost to
get rid of all these treaties that encumber us, and we march off.
Out means out. People like that kind of talk.
But it won't
mean
out, because immediately we will start signing other treaties and making all sorts of other, you know.
But I don't think it ever would have been. I think that there was already like micro deals done on aviation and certain movement things. So I think the stakes were so high for both bodies that it would never have been quite what they said it was going to be. But I remember you wrote this article about, like, you know, the sort of antipathy towards Leave voters. And you said, you know, that's my dad you're talking about. Yeah. And I think that that's one thing that maybe certainly the artistic liberal left missed out on, was that statistically, you're always really likely to know quite a lot of people that voted Leave.
Yeah.
And to hear him spoken about in that pejorative way was always going to come
up. Although I had issues with a lot of what he said in his rant, Andrew Lawrence's famous Facebook rant, you know, and I think unfortunately he muddied the water a lot for himself there by making certain completely unnecessary references and so on that, you know, confused it. But one of his main points was that, you know, Mock the Week, among others, had failed to recognise any legitimacy to you know, UKIP's message or anyone who wanted out. And consequently, there was this kind of bottled anger, you know, which half the country weren't seeing their views represented on the television. They were seeing Nigel Farage on Question Time, but they weren't seeing the more relaxed conversation in which, you know, on the one hand this, but on the other hand that, you know, they had no sense of that. And so this resentment, you know.
Well, yeah,
and then
I mean,
bang, out it comes on polling day, and nobody, you know, can believe it. And it's not healthy. You've got to, if you're a comedian, well, as one comedian, of course, you're entitled to do whatever you want. But for those people who are responsible for, you know, programming comedy clubs or you know, defining the and there are people who have the capacity, you know, to balance panels on radio or TV shows or whatever. They have a responsibility, I think, to make sure that all those views are heard, because otherwise, you know, anger really does build up.
Well, it's odd, really, because it sort of happened as a consequence of the Blair years. Maybe things have become a bit apolitical.
Yeah.
It was people were used to sort of protesting, you know, if the left are about protest more, it's against ideas, the Iraq war. And even when the Tories got in coalition, it was more a case of austerity was the thing that people were opposed to. The Bullingdon Club was the thing that people were opposed to.
Yeah.
It was only really, and I always say this, I think the most underestimated election result was 2015, because that was the first one that came out of the bubble.
Yeah.
And people were, I thought we were all going to vote, you know, Labour. First shock result.
I thought it'd be another hung parliament.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think Cameron did too. I don't think he would have offered that referendum, actually.
He never got any predictions right, did he? He was like, no. I think I've got this.
Andrew Cooper, his pollster, was the man responsible for that secure conviction.
Yeah.
Anyway, I agree with you. I think that was... Well, and also, actually, the Indy ref for Scotland, which gave us a full sense of security that, oh, it always goes to the wire and then they pull back in the end.
The rule of the incumbent was quoted a lot, wasn't it?
Even though the referendum was phrased in such a way that the Nats could go, yes, and it was us going, no, you know, which was a bad way around. No, it should have been, do you want to stay together? Yes, you know.
I think one thing we learned is phrasing is really important.
Massive. A friend of mine, if you've listened to Coastal Market, you'll know Marion Somerset Webb. She's like a financial consultant and stuff, and editor of Moneyweek and things. She's made some really interesting points about the way that referendum questions are phrased and the way election manifest slogans are phrased. She's like Trump, for instance, make America great again.
Mm.
It's an active, simply expressed, you know, verbal, you know, it's a very, very powerful, it's got forward motion, it's propulsive. Mm. Hillary Clinton's campaign slogan was, I'm with her. I mean, it's like you couldn't come up with something less motivating, could you? It's like, you know, it's like somebody sort of says when they're trying to get into a party, but they're not really invited. I'm with her.
If anything, maybe the left have underestimated how important that is. I mean, Corbyn is a poor communicator. Ed Miliband wasn't prime ministerial. You look at the last person to win a majority was Cameron.
Mm.
And this is terrible. He just seemed like he knew what he was doing.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? It's the old cut of his jib thing.
Yeah.
And now, it turns out maybe he wasn't quite so clued up. But somebody like me, and I wonder if there is that sort of like inbuilt class thing that I saw one bloke to sound a bit like you to run the country. Maybe, because I think I get a sense of reassurance when
confidence, absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, and that is not that, again, to emphasise that I had it, but that is what private school teaches you more than anything else, isn't it? Is to adopt the attitude that you were born to rule. I mean, that's what public schools literally were for, really, in their glory years. They were to prepare the ruling classes for that, and that's why they had to be separated from... To be intelligent didn't help. You were being, you know, elevated to that rule. We do all respond to that. We are basically like dogs at the end of the day, you know.
I think being tall as well.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at, like, and we're bearing that in mind, the idea that anybody thought Neil Kinnock could win an election, right? He's bald, he's ginger, and he's Welsh. Now, I'm not saying that he's inherently wrong to be any one of those things, but individually, they don't play out well with the electorate. Collectively,
Evening Standard, when Tony Blair, I can't remember if it was his first or second election, but I remember seeing there was a big graphic. It was like a Peter Brooks cartoon or something, and it said, would he have won if? And then there were six pictures of him. He was bald, he was a woman, he was black or Asian, he had... can't remember, sort of buck teeth. I mean, they just changed the sort of feature of him a little bit each time.
I mean, off that list, I'm thinking buck teeth. Actually, and
there was a thing, you know, one of them where he basically looked a bit bald. He looked like William Hague. I think it must have been the second one, because I just remember thinking, I think Hague was a very competent politician. And I don't know how tall he is. He gave the impression of being small, but... It was basically, you know, without to lose your hair that early on, you're basically going, it's not.
But isn't that odd as humans that we hold that against
him? Awful,
you
terrible,
idiot.
Terrible.
Fuck a bit. How can I trust him
normally,
with the economy?
These
if he can't
people
keep
normally
his hair?
Then they find a warhead to get behind. Yeah. You know, they're the Cromwells, you know, or the Woolses, you know, who latch on to power and are able to administrate it from behind the scenes. That certainly happened in Russia and in America, I think, you know. I mean, Reagan was a great example. Reagan was a very, very effective president, even, to be honest, though he probably was beginning to experience serious dementia, I think, towards the end, in hindsight, you know.
Yeah.
He remained effective because he put a great team together, and he himself just had that literally film-style charisma, you know.
Mm.
And there's nothing wrong with that system, as long as the people know what team they're voting for when it's put together.
Thatcher, to a degree, was an example of charisma.
She was. Her team changed over the time, but she was lucky with the Falklands War, which I think otherwise she'd have been out on her ear in the first, you know, the first cycle. But she did. She came in and she had people like Keith Joseph who were the sort of, you know, the... just like Blair had with Mandelson, you know. Mm. Mandelson would never have been a prime minister. Blair is obviously a very capable man himself.
Who's the old guy, the famous press officer that she had, who was like one of
that she had?
Yes.
Bernard Ingham.
Bernard Ingham.
With the huge eyebrows, yeah. I don't know that he was her amanuensis or whatever. I don't think that he was necessarily like the kind of philosopher guide of the party. He was a very effective communicator, certainly, and helped her too. I don't know who it was who told us to get the elocution lessons. There's that scene in the movie, isn't it? But I think it was Roger Allam, as it usually is.
It's funny, that film, though, isn't it? Just a reminder of how the Yanks see things sometimes.
Yeah.
You even get people that I suppose would have friends on the liberal left in this country that would think that they had something in common. But like, your political legacy overseas is distilled through an even tighter sort of lens, isn't it?
That's very true.
Simply, did you have good catchphrases?
Yeah.
How long did you stay there? Are they making
Thatcher is probably the only British Prime Minister since Churchill of whom Hollywood has an opinion at all.
I think Blair, but they're not a good opinion.
Never make a movie about him.
But even they, I mean, it's strange.
You couldn't open a movie about him in America, Blair.
Yeah.
He's
had cameos in other people's films.
Was he in Vice? He wasn't in Vice, was he? Did you see Vice?
I didn't see Vice, no. Yeah. But he's in The Queen, wasn't he?
Oh, was he?
Well, yeah. Maybe this is like a sort of an example of like, you know, Thatcher had her own film. Blair does cameos in other people's films.
Yes.
Then you might appear in a couple of TV... Theresa May, I think, at best would be in a TV drama. Like,
what most people think.
But with Brexit, I think the best way to understand it in those terms is that joining the European community or at least agreeing to stay within it, campaigning, the Conservatives campaigned to stay within it, Thatcher included, of course, enthusiastically in 75, that wasn't conservative. That was a radical change in our constitutional affairs. Gradually over the time that we've been a member of the European community, as it's changed the European Union, it's accelerated towards an ever more radical rearrangement of our constitutional affairs and our relationship to other countries and our sovereignty and so on. And that this is like a thing that we now want to leap off because it's not a static institution in itself. That's the key thing to understand. If you think of the EU membership as being static, then Brexit is unquestionably not the Conservative response to it.
Mm.
Stay within it and campaign hard for the right to, I don't know, have alternative treaties, you know, or to limit freedom of movement or whatever. That would be the, you know. But if you accept, and I'm not saying you should, but that's just the way to understand it. If you accept that the EU is not a static project, it's a dynamic project, and it is quite explicitly moving towards political union, you know, irrevocable levels, you know, dissolution of nation state. Then to withdraw from that, it remains the most conservative option that you can have if you look across the span of the century, you know. But as always with politics, you're trying to operate on such a tiny level of like day-to-day detail, you know. If you take back even, I mean, I think about this quite a lot when you look at the history, you know, of the last 1,000 years in Europe or whatever, all sorts of things that looked catastrophic at the time, or certainly tumultuous. But would you want them to not have happened?
Well, and also you talk about the level of day-to-day detail that we're operating on. And I would never portray myself or seek to be the most clued up guy. But then when it comes to something like the EU, so you get these guys, we've both been on Question Time, right?
Yeah.
We've both been through that. They're bright, they're intelligent guys, they know a lot, they've read
the other guys on the panel?
The FBPE, the guys on Twitter, right? They seem to be mainly between the age of about 30 and 45, it seems to be. And they sort of say, you know, their main thing seems to be knowledge and expertise. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But I sort of think, yeah, it's very likely that you might know more about the EU than me. Mm. But there's so much to know. You might know double of me, but you might know 2%, and I might know 1%.
Yes, exactly.
Neither of us know fuck all in the grand scheme of things.
It's not actually
that big a difference when you look at it.
It is encouraging when you occasionally find somebody who's very well informed and is, you know, heterodox in their opinion, like, you know, very well informed about the EU and still doesn't like it, you know.
Yes.
And I take some encouragement from that, but I absolutely agree with what you're saying. It is almost pointless to just constantly educate yourself, because essentially all you're doing is like filling your arsenal with weapons that you can use to win pub arguments. We very rarely as humans, you know, the species very rarely goes, oh, I didn't realise that. Oh, well, in that case, I think, you know, you always...
Well, that's just, what I think. I think as well, a lot of these arguments and stuff, and I the last time I went on Question Time, I got like quite a violent backlash for something I said about, I called out Donald Tusk and I said that he didn't have the balls to come and do like live debate shows and stuff. And then I went further and said he hasn't got the stones for it. So I was almost, I think subconsciously, deliberately being the prick that they hate me for.
Also,
I do think that one of them should have appeared on a Mara Question Time at some point, but that's a separate debate. But there is this strange world out there of men, and, you know, they're normally, I guess what they would prefer to be seen as progressive in normal terms, right? Or feminist even. And yet when you see those same men speak to a woman who's from the right, the level of sexism, or they feel like somehow because she's a woman she's got to be nice and be of the left. I find this, it just doesn't take long before they show themselves up to be massive hypocrites.
It's interesting, isn't it? It happens in America even more so. Any woman who is in favour of Trump is essentially perceived to be like a whore of the right. by the left. You know, they just think, oh, he's like some sort of, you know, biker chick or something, you know, that doesn't really understand the arguments. Yeah, they're just drawn to shiny black boots.
Well, there's girls, you know, work for the Taxpayers Alliance and stuff, and they go out and they go on shows. Now you can dispute what the taxpayers, you know, or the IEA are.
Hoof nudge you.
But they get, you know, you silly little girl and all this. I'm like, you're just retweeting Catelyn Moran and stuff. I think that, you know, you've got to credit that these girls, as you put it, have come to their own opinion. So
I don't know that we do all come to our own opinion. I don't know. I'm not saying that the women do, but I'm just saying they do as much as the men do. I think we all tend to gather around tribes, you know, we all tend to herd if we're not careful. It's very hard to sustain independent thought. I just think that's the thing. I think endlessly, like, finding out more facts is not necessarily going to leave you better informed in a meaningful sense. That sounds kind of counterintuitive and sort of anti-intellectual, but it can all, you know, because for every fact there's always a counterfact, you know, and you will always know. I don't care how clever you are and convinced of your argument, there's someone out there who would beat you in the eyes of a neutral observer in an argument.
The problem for me, Simon, though, is I made that decision when I was 22.
Yeah.
Okay, just a quick plug, a quick reminder. I'm going to be the Edinburgh Fringe. I know I talk about the tour a lot. The Edinburgh Fringe from the 12th to the 25th of August. So I'm going to be doing a work in progress in the run-up to my autumn tour, which is September. That's probably something new thing like Stoptober. Stoptember. That's for people that just got like more than one thing to quit. Like in Stoptober, you stop drinking, right? Stoptember, you know, you stop looking at porn before lunch. Every bloke has to manage that, you know. Anyway, why am I taking this down the murky route? All I'm saying is, and this is why probably I don't do that well at the Edinburgh Fringe, is because I like talking about porn and wanking, but is I'm going to be at the Edinburgh Fringe doing a work in progress run, and it's going to be like, it's cheaper, so, you know, if you're at the Edinburgh Fringe, I don't know how many of you are coming up to the Edinburgh Fringe, how many of you are like well cultured, or are you like me at the Edinburgh Fringe, you go there for a bit of culture. You think, you know what, I'm going to see an African core tribe during the day, I'm going to see a dance troupe, and then I'm going to watch like some narrative comedy. And then I go Nando's, I go to cinema. I can't tell you how many times I've been to a cinema in Edinburgh. That's a fucking disgrace, isn't it? I was just trying to think what the most mainstream film was that I watched while I could have been watching the greatest arts festival in the world. I went and saw Dunkirk during the Fringe. This is maybe why I am a leaver. The rest of them were all taking in art from all around the globe, and I was sitting there just crying over Spitfires. I don't know if I've mentioned that before on the podcast. But anyway, look, Edinburgh Fringe, if you fancy it, I'll be there. Lovely to see you too. Let's get back to the chat with Simon Evans. But yeah, I increasingly, as I got older, like I went to university and I thought, you know, gender is a construct, and I've got to a certain age. And I don't know if this is an excuse for my own behaviour. Have you got kids yourself?
Yeah,
got kids, boys and girls.
One of each, yeah.
And how, what's your view on gender? How old are they now? If you don't
know, Tilda's 15. Everybody's be 12 in July.
And how closely have they stuck to sort of gender norms, or are they quite sort of?
They are quite close to them. They've been. We've communicated to them that we would be fine if they were gay, or if any of them wanted to, you know, explore anything, but. I think, although I communicate those two things to them in sort of earnest conversation, there are probably other times when they pick
up. Put them off it for life.
Yeah. I want you to know that it's absolutely fine with me if you turn out to be you know, one of them. No, but the thing
that's
is...
That's like all good middle-class parenting, a lot of implied stuff, isn't it? Going across the table,
I do have some concerns that... I mean, I don't know if this is exactly what you meant by the question, but I do have some concerns that too much unguided liberty is being offered to young people who might benefit from a little bit more, you know, constructive framework in their lives rather than simply do and be anything you want. You know?
I think it's a great way to put it. I mean, it's because the thing is, when you think about what we should be encouraging teenagers to do, you only have your reference for how you felt when you was a teenager.
Yeah.
And also when I went back to it as a teacher... And it is a scary sort of nebulous time of life where they're literally just atoms are fucking floating off into the ether. And I certainly found that as a teacher, and this is now a tenuous relation to what we're talking about, but just the moment you put me in front of a class of kids, I was a disciplinarian, like instinctively, in a heartbeat. I never was like that at work, hopefully not like that as a bloke to deal with, you know. But I was right, okay. And I was really, I wouldn't take any back chat, any disrespect. But that was just because I thought this is what they need at this point in life. And I suppose that was probably a time for me politically. You know, like you have those watershed moments. You go, shit, I didn't think I was going to be like Mr. Gradbury.
Well, it depends who you're addressing, I think, in terms of a classroom. But broadly speaking, in any average comprehensive school class, let's say there's 30 kids in there. If you don't exert at least, you know, a certain level of discipline, 25 of those kids will be let down by that experience because the other 5 will take the opportunity to make your life, you know, miserable, and they will just lack the self-discipline necessary. Yeah. There are different kinds of classes and makeups of children that might swing back one way or the other.
I think it's one group I'm quite comfortable stereotyping is teenagers.
Yeah.
I think it becomes
tyranny of the minority then. It's just, you know, it's just the loudest, you know, the loudest hinges or whatever. They will distract all your attention. So that is a specific dynamic. Whether you can apply that to, you know, does a country like Britain, would it benefit from a fascist state? I don't know, you know, that's a fairly big question. But it's never seemed as if it needs one, because I think there is actually quite a high level of... the countries that do fall the most quickly to fascism are the ones like Brazil, currently at the moment, for instance, which had veered the most dangerously close to chaos when they had what half the nation felt was too much liberty. You know, they've made a democratic choice to go, no, we need much more authoritarian rule here now. And the rest of the world might kind of, you know, hold up its hands in horror. But that is clearly what half of Brazil has decided it needs, because otherwise society falls apart.
That human thing of overcorrection, because it was interesting, we're sort of going through the sort of micro to the macro quite quickly. But like, I think, like, you know, like when women are younger and they're dating, if they date guys and they date a complete bastard, right?
Yeah.
Next guy is an absolute sap.
Yeah.
Like, what is that in humans? It's quite, because the thing is, it's supposed to take you away from danger, but in itself, self is dangerous, isn't it?
Does that actually happen? I don't know if that is. I think women who like complete bastards. Yeah. Right, okay.
Well, they probably date quite a few bastards.
Yeah, right.
But then at the point where they realise they need something different, they go, I'm going to date a fucking librarian. Yeah. And then they think, oh, actually, that was terrible. I need to go back to the bastards, right?
Right.
When what they really needed was a guy with a leather jacket that reads books.
Anyway,
at the end of the show here, I like to do a couple of letters, actually, just get a bit of the sort of collective wisdom of my guests.
Okay.
So just a few here. Have you got time?
Yeah, of course.
Cool. So the first one is from, and yeah, I do like dealing with the tension between old-fashioned and new gender roles. And this is from, I'll tell you it's from afterwards because it'll make more sense. My wife earns more than me. The fact that I laughed instinctively at that shows that I am not as sort of evolved as possibly I should be.
Yeah. Is it a bloke?
I think so, yeah. Okay. I've become a house husband.
Okay.
Again, I don't like it. I'm happy to do it, but everyone expects me to be 100% delighted when it's just about pragmatism. Am I being daft? Is this a brilliant opportunity? Will I regret feeling this way? And it's from Anonymous from Weymouth.
So it's a genuine letter, this?
Yes, yeah. I get people sort of email in. I just think it's kind of funny and sad that he's decided to be anonymous. Now, but I always try and be honest. I go, I totally get that. Do you know what I mean? I get that. You can sort of say, yes, she earns more, and this is right for us now.
We don't know whether they have children.
I'd imagine, well, he said
he
house
wouldn't
husband,
otherwise they would
so
just,
I'd
yeah,
imagine that there's
yeah.
sort of kids care in there.
Yeah.
Is he going to get to 65, I suppose, and is he going to go, wow, what a unique opportunity for a bloke in my family to be sort of, implicit in the real formative years of my children's life. But on the other hand,
my instinctive response is that if he was happy with it, nobody should judge him for that. But if he's not happy with it, then I think he's entirely within his rights to say, no, if you want to work, fine, and we'll get a nanny in. As long as my wages cover the nanny and I'm able to earn enough and I'm happier in the workplace, then that's an entirely legitimate. It's every bit as legitimate as it would be and often is for a wife who doesn't earn as much as the husband to nevertheless say, yeah, but I still want to work, so we'll get a nanny in. Now, I think the best solution to this, it's something I think a lot about, because, you know, as a stand-up comedian, if you're not careful, you end up being the default house husband, even if you're earning more, because you're there during the day.
Yes.
You know, and you're kind of going, well, I can sort of work while I'm sort of here, and, you know, a couple of school runs and a toothache, and your day's really sort of disrupted. So I do think it's, you know, it's perfectly reasonable to say, you do a day, I'll do a day, 3 days with the nanny. Then we're all having like some meaningful, you know, time. Plus we've got the weekends, you know, or alternate or two and three or something like that. All that sort of stuff is fine. But there's no way that a bloke should be bullied, essentially, by a sort of inverse
expectation. But I like the fact you've laid
it. He's basically saying he's not happy about it, and still it's carrying on. So obviously some sort of psychological pressure is being brought to bear on him. Otherwise he wouldn't do it, right?
I also think when I read stuff like that, it just makes me realise I instinctively laugh at the word house husband.
Yeah.
Because
he won't be doing it, will he?
No, no, he won't. And I just imagine like a facial expression of a put upon guy who's sort of got stuff in his hand. And this is my own issue, but I'm projecting onto him that he wants to be doing something else. Now, I know the blokes listen to this show, and I'm sure this is the kind of modern standard sort of disclaimer you have to do. There are some great house husbands out there. But even the fact that I'm saying it like that means that I don't think there are that many that are that into doing
it. There's a great book I'm reading at the moment called The Ape That Understood the Universe. But to be honest, there are dozens of books like this. But that's a good example about sort of evolutionary psychology and sexual dimorphism. You know, it's universal in all species. You know, there's no discussion among chimps or gorillas, let alone woodpeckers or whatever, who's going to stay at home and look after the nest. If a bloke wants to do it, of course, fine. But the idea that he should just feel, well, that's the only calculation that's relevant, she earns more, therefore I'll do it. No.
Yeah.
It's what you feel comfortable doing with your life. And if he doesn't want to do that, then they should find a third way. Most jobs now, you can at least do a day a week at home.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that's good advice. I didn't even think about that. As long as you cover the nanny, and you know, and also if you have sort of allowed yourself to go to seed a bit, again, I'm making presumptions here, but the old man boobs are now running perhaps a B or even a C cup, and you're probably a bit too addicted to daytime television.
She's not going to be happy either.
Right now. I would say, don't go back straight back
she'll
to work.
She'll swing back to bastards if you're not careful.
Yeah, she'll go back to bastards, right? She may already be. This is what happens with the advice. I end up sort of fucking with their minds. But I would say don't just go straight back to work. Just get yourself in shape. Just
bit start of kickboxing.
Yeah, bit of kickboxing first. Get that testosterone up. Yeah. Start, you know, lose the mat. Make sure that when you hit that workplace, because you don't want to feel...
Right.
You want to be shredded.
You don't want to have stale milk on your cuffs.
Most people think.
This is from someone who listens to podcasts who says, "Do you think we'll all end up regretting not taking Theresa's deal? I never read it, but I decided it was terrible based on what extreme Remain and Brexiteers were telling me, but they had their own vested interests. Maybe it wasn't that bad."
Well, I mean, I don't know what new insights I can bring to this vexed question after 6 months of thinking about very little else.
But is it? I mean, that was the thing, that the people that didn't want it were the people that thought this is a great moment to either leverage a WTO Brexit or remain at all costs.
Yeah,
so
it's true.
I never read the report.
Yeah.
I just don't.
I know a couple of people whose opinions I respect who have read it and think it was she picked the wrong red lines, you know, and I tend to agree with that. I mean, Theresa's red lines, of course, were all about immigration and free movement, which I personally don't think was the biggest problem at all.
No.
You know, and I honestly think that we were sold a pup in terms of immigration through the EU channels by successive prime ministers who should have been much more clear about the fact that we could actually limit it if we wanted to, and we were just failing to do so, you know, because we thought we had economic advantages. I understand, like, you know, Gordon Brown's bigoted woman up in Wakefield or wherever it was, you know, suddenly the high street's full of Romanian delicatessens and she doesn't know what's going on, and that is a genuine, you know, and I honestly think
rapid
legitimate
change.
Concern, But to be honest, immigration in this country is not limited to free movement from European people.
No.
And if anything, I find, you know, the Poles are probably among the easiest people to immediately, you know, there's a lot of overlapping culture and history and so on. So, you know, things could be a lot worse in terms of fast-moving change in culture and so on. I think it's a very, you know, I have to be delicate in saying that, but I don't think we should have allowed the concern about the Irish border to overwhelm the entire project, you know.
Mm.
Who knows what the long-term future of Ireland is. Was it 1998, the Good Friday Agreement, something like that? I think at that point it was widely understood that the Catholic majority would have kicked in by now and that Ireland would be reunified anyway. You know, they were basically holding the ball up until the... till the consensus was there. Sadly, the Catholics stopped breeding almost as entirely as the Protestants have. So you've kind of got another strange situation now. But I think it's a very dangerous situation to kind of say the risk of violence erupting once again in Northern Ireland means that the entire body of the mainland is unable to seek, self-determination.
That's exactly what I thought. And
if violence was held over as a sort of moral blackmail about the British people being able to seek their own destiny, that would be very quickly there's no way you start kind of threatening us with violence to get your own way, but that's essentially what's happening
in
Ireland.
It did sound kind of like one of those loaded mafia kingpin moments. It'll be terrible if that was to kick off.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys would be in all sorts of trouble.
It's been very sweet here for some time.
Yeah, I love you guys, but there's a lot of crazy people there.
But I think with Theresa's deal, the best that can be said of it is no one would be happy. Everyone would be able to blame the other side for what had been the failure to capitalise on the opportunities. And so in that respect, there would be less triumphalism. And so that might be one of those funny old British fudges that have worked throughout the years. But, you know, if that's what we end up with at the end of this whole process, it will certainly have been an absolutely catastrophic waste of time, energy and money, that would be a shame.
Yeah.
Whereas if we did go forward with no deal, it might be like a tiny version of the 30 Years War or whatever, but, you know, would you rather we still lived under Catholic hegemony? I don't know. You know, the experts of the Catholic Church were there to tell everyone in Luther's time, you know, we all know that you mustn't break with Rome, that would be terrible.
Well, but they said that one of the most catastrophic predictions for GDP were that it would be sort of 7%, maybe even as much as 9% over 15 years, right? So which is, you know, and that's over
15 years.
That's not shrinkage.
Yeah.
That's less than it would have otherwise been.
Not necessarily even a recession.
No, and that works out at roughly 0.5% of GDP a year, right? Mm. Now, that is enough money to build schools, houses, put policemen, nurses to work and stuff. Real undoubtedly. Money. The question is whether the British general public would be able to even notice that, or whether it would be objectively demonstrable. Certainly after a period of time, because then the economic data is then dependent on much bigger events.
Well,
globally.
Then you're exactly absolutely right. Within 2 years, something else will happen.
Nothing to do with Brexit. This is due to the fact that Argentina has nuked Brazil.
Every time a car factory, you know, moves its operations overseas, now half the country thinks it's Brexit. Half the country goes, it's not Brexit. I don't know. I mean, the way the car manufacturers generally, to follow with that example, that have been presenting it, they normally go, no, actually this is just because, you know, we now sell more cars in China than we do in Europe or whatever. But, you know, it will be people will try and spin it, but once they've lost the fight, they might just shut up about it.
Tristan FBPE will tell you he's definitely to do with Brexit. Yeah, I think it's probably better to listen to Tristan than the head of Honda.
Britain is now post-industrial largely, and lots of gentlemen, my own father included, you know, struggle to understand that. But, you know, our future is not building cars, you know, our future is in insurance, you know, and systems management, that kind of stuff. You know, that's where the City of London, obviously, but these kind of, the idea that we're selling fucking toothbrushes to, you know, Milan, that's the kind of model people have in their heads, and obviously they have a few cases of genuine concern.
You remember the glory days of toothbrushes to Milan? My father used to work down the toothbrush mining pit.
Before Michael Caine buggered it up with all that. But that's just one example of the various dimensions of it that people don't fully understand. And the other thing I get really angry about is this kind of, oh God, in a no deal Brexit, immediately all the cancer drugs would stop coming into this country because that's up to us. We will allow things in.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not, you know, we can decide, you know, whether or not certain drugs are exempt from our new rules and regulations. No government, whether it be Corbyn, May, or, you know, the most likely Brexit, you know, Lib Dem coalition or whatever we're looking at, none of them are going to go, no, I'm sorry, but, you know, Brexit means Brexit, no more cancer drugs. That stuff coming in is, you know, that's up to us.
I think that actually there's a lot of Project Fear that didn't land with the public, I think.
Yeah.
I think the one about the NHS and drugs and care did. I think that was a big success for them. because it was sort of like the stakes got so high that even if there's a slight delay in certain drugs, I agree that there wouldn't be because we wouldn't want there to be. But I think that was one of their first big successes.
It's weird, isn't it, how emotive it is, because it's the same route that people against immigration will take in order to convince you that immigration is a bad thing. They will say the NHS is overwhelmed. Mm. Well, but that is an absurdity because the NHS is run by immigrants. I mean, it's almost about 80% staffed by, you know, people born outside of the United Kingdom, you know.
That's become such a truism now. People on the Brexit side have started looking at the problems that Romanians have staffing their own NHS.
Yes, exactly.
That's
a
more sustainable argument.
Yeah. Well, I do think that's an interesting problem. Of course, it's probably not done in good faith, you know. I mean, they kind of, it's mainly the Bulgarians I'm worried about, you know, for their own sake. But I saw a Bulgarian sort of, an economics and governmental expert speaking at some sort of conference I randomly invited to recently. And I had not understood the extent to which EU membership has just hollowed out. Bulgaria is like empty. Something like 30% of its young people have left. I don't know. It's about shifting the mindset, I guess. But I instinctively feel that Bulgarians will... poor... Mm. And I suppose naturally static Bulgarians will become quite disaffected.
Yeah.
They will start to feel...
It's weird not to have young people around.
Yeah,
although,
exactly,
if the world wars are anything to go by, they'll write great poetry for a while.
Yeah, that's true.
The moment the young Mendes are fucking poetry, will go through the roof. Just one last one here.
Yeah.
One's a bit of,
sorry, we're on questions, aren't we? Yeah, sorry, I completely forgot. Yeah.
No, it's a great route into the Brexit chat. this is from Kelly, who I don't know is male or female, but so I'll just read it. My mother-in-law is a fucking nightmare. I know it's cliche to feel this way, but also when it's happening, it's really bad, so I cannot call it just because. That's not grammatically...
Yeah.
She's trying to raise our son differently. Why is this okay? She was a real bitch to my husband when he grew up. Really mean. Now she wants to feel better about herself at the expense of our rules. Should I just tell her to fuck off? Tricky one.
I had to switch horses in midstream there. I'd assume that was in your voice. I thought it was a bloke talking.
It's
a woman
Kelly,
talking.
It's
sorry,
a female Kelly,
Kelly
yeah, from Solihull. Yeah.
Her husband's mother.
I just love the first sentence. My lover-in-law is a fucking nightmare. That way, you know, when you say someone's a nightmare, everyone knows exactly what you mean, don't they?
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
what it's like to be yeah. around a nightmare. So just to kind of break it down.
Permanent presence for a start, I assume.
Well, she appears to... I get what she's saying here, is that she wasn't a very nice mother, and now she's using their child to kind of offset that, but, like, it's making their life objectively worse. So I guess I probably feel sorry for the husband here, because he had a shit upbringing, and now he's seeing his mum be all gracious and lovely and dishing out
the
curly whirlies.
Shit upbringings, isn't it, is that they can turn out nice people, so you just don't know... There's an awful lot of variables in here which aren't, you know, obviously detailed. But firstly, do they live together? It sounds like if he's having that much influence, is it? I mean, how often is she around there? The old mother-in-law jokes, of course, all stem from the days when people literally sort of had, you know, to live at home at first, didn't they?
This is one of the things that's forgotten about mother-in-law jokes. It's like society and life was a lot more simplistic then.
Yeah.
A lot less channels on telly, a lot less restaurants to go to. A lot of it, you're sat in the house.
Three of you round the table.
And you know what? Like, you can only make humour about the things that frustrate you.
Yeah, of course, absolutely. My instinct is to say, of course, you should assert your own right to raise your children as you can, but there might be something to be gained. I mean, without having met or seen them, of course, it's very hard to know. But I think you should always try, at first, confront people, including... I remember my mother and father-in-law came and stayed in our basement flat for a little while, which had previously been my little office and stuff, and they were between house moves, so they came in for the weekend. It became a weekend, ended up being 3 months, which is fine. But in about 2 weeks in, I was at the kitchen and a bedroom and a little lounge down there and everything. About 2 weeks in, they'd started drifting upstairs, and they'd often be already having a cup of tea and toast and marmalade in the kitchen when I'd come down in my pants in the morning, you know, a little bit later than
the
kids. And I was like, my day hasn't started. I haven't had my first coffee, and there's the in-laws in the kitchen. So
how's that rage? The rage that you feel in moments like that.
Three or four days into this, I was like, I'm sorry, but I can't do this. If they're going to stay there, they need to have some house rules. So I went down and I sat them down and I said, I'm really sorry to be blunt with you, but I think, you know, weak communication makes for bad situations. I don't want you in the kitchen. without having been specifically invited up. You've got a flat down here. You've got everything you need to make your own breakfast.
Yeah.
If I'm out in the evening and Kate wants to invite you up to have dinner with her or whatever, of course, that's absolutely fine. But I don't want the default to be that you just feel the whole house is yours. I'm really sorry, but this is a family home and I need to have my own space here. And I really sort of took a deep breath and said it all like that straight to them, you know, not like sort of joking or anything. Mm. And they went, absolutely, completely understand. I'm terribly sorry.
I have nothing but respect for the way that you handled that. I could almost feel the collective gasp and intake of air. Anybody listeners, because that is a massive shout, isn't it?
It was a big shout. And afterwards, I had that kind of high that you have when you've gone and done your first open spot. You know, I was like, oh my God, I did it. I was like, surging.
Did you go around telling other people to come in Laura's? You stay down in the fucking flat as well.
But absolutely, relations were much healthier after that. You know, it cleared the air and it was good. So with your mother-in-law, I think that would be, you know, the way to do it.
But people aren't used to somebody being that proactive. I've had a similar situation in my own family life where I took a similar stance to you. And I think, again, it worked out for the better. But what people mostly seem to prefer to do is to allow things to fester.
Yeah.
And then that becomes something that they always discuss with certain people.
Yeah, exactly,
so it becomes this running kind of sitcom thread. Well, so guess who was up to his old tricks again? Hey,
yeah.
You know, like giving me stares while I was here. Well, I was just sitting in his kitchen, staring at me across the table.
There's a lot of people who've talked about this. Scott Adams is very good on this. Do you know Scott Adams? Mm-hmm. He wrote the cartoons with the, what's it called? Dingle or something, some bloke in Dilbert.
Yeah.
Do you remember Dilbert, sort of office life cartoons? Anyway, right. He's made quite a splash for himself lately, Scott Adams, because he predicted Trump's election from about 2 years before it, basically. Yeah. And a lot of people said he's like pro-Trump, but I think actually he is cleverer than that. I think what he's done is he's basically analysed what was going to happen because who was addressing the emotional pitch correctly.
Yeah.
And he says people absolutely depend on their pain. They live for their pain. They don't want to lose their pain. Their pain defines them. They find themselves in uncomfortable, limiting situations. They're terrified of freedom. They're terrified of releasing themselves from these situations and having to take responsibility for what happens next. And so they would rather live in this kind of miserable, squalid resentment than kind of go, right, I'm going to get rid of this now. This is gone, you know?
And you did it.
I did it. My parents, my in-laws, are quite reasonable people. And she was fine. In fact, she was grateful as well, you know. She loved her dad very much. Her dad's passed away since then, but not as a direct result of that. But her mum's still around. But she gets on with her mum, but I think there's that classic sort of daughter-mum thing, a little bit of, you know, argy-bargy or whatever. But she was absolutely fine with it. And, of course, she recognised that I was being quite reasonable, allowing them to stay there at all for 3 months, you know. We were all better for it. But not everyone is lucky enough to have a mother-in-law that will go, actually, that's perfectly reasonable. You know, she might have a mother-in-law that's going to like fly off the handle. But if that does happen, then you've moved on to the next stage of the argument. And now you say, I'm sorry, but until you recognise that I, as the mother and the senior, you know, parent in relationship to my child, I'm sorry, but you're not coming round here and getting involved until you can learn to behave yourself.
I love it.
That's a bit harsher again.
So you can learn to behave. So I love it. I think it's a great point at which to conclude the podcast is what you've essentially done is on a family level, you've drained the swamp. you've lanced the boil. You know,
I've made that family great again.
And you may... You've made that family great again. And I think, Kelly, you're in a slightly different... I think gender is a part here, but if you do the Simon Evans approach, I want you to record it, and I want us all to hear
secret recording. I think that would probably be,
And Simon, just before you go, have you got anything coming up? Are you at Edinburgh this year?
I'm at Edinburgh this year, and I've got a show. It's called Dressing for Dinner, but it's not really about that. There's quite a significant revelation, which I'm keeping under my hat, that will emerge over the course of the show. It's quite an interesting story. Unusually for me, I'm normally just yattering on for an hour, but I've actually got something to say this year, interesting news.
And the tickets are on sale now?
Usual places at the Edinburgh box office or whatever. Yeah, I'm in the assembly rooms in George Square. Nice evening slot, about 8 o'clock in the evening.
Well, do buy those tickets because they will sell out.
Thank you.
And Jeff, enjoy the run. And listeners, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Absolute pleasure. I'll see you on Pointless Celebrities.
Yes, we're recording that next week. I think it goes out in the autumn. I've got no idea why they've put us together. But what I did back on, we now have a fully working rapport.
That's right. Yeah. Absolutely. Sorted.
Brilliant.
Thanks, mate. Cheers.
Cheers. Okay, that is the end of the chat with Simon Evans. Hope you enjoyed it. I thought that story about him and his mother-in-law, his in-laws. That was just, it's funny, isn't it? The things in life that can cause great drama. You can talk about politics, you know what I mean? You can talk about sport or wars. But when it comes down to it, the idea of one man, one brave man going down to the flat at the bottom of his house and just facing down the tyranny of the in-laws. I'm not saying his in-laws are tyrannical, but that was a moment of high drama, and I enjoyed it, and I hope you did too. Just a quick bit of, not men's mental health and stuff, but I just thought it'd be an interesting one to mention, because obviously I've spoken on this very podcast in the last couple of months about anxiety, right? We used the metaphor about, and by the way, all of you are going, shut up with the fucking men's mental health stuff. Some of us should get on with it. Okay, you know, good for you. Just take this next couple of minutes as a reminder of what an absolute diamond geezer you're being, right? But I thought I was cooking, you know. From the start of this year, I've been really busy, but feeling in really good nick. Do you know what I mean? Really good form. And just at that point where I thought, like, oh yeah, I think I've cracked it now. I don't think I'll ever have, I don't think my Swede will ever fucking wobble again. I was in a writing room the other day, and I just sat down and just had the panics, mate. I just had the panics. I don't know where it came from. And I think I was feeling a bit ill as well and stuff. And I've been in this writing room a lot over the last few weeks. I just sat down. I got the fear. I mean, it properly rose up in me. And then I stepped out of the room and I went to the toilet. And I was... Then I got the fear about the fear. Do you ever get that? I got fear. And, you know, then I had gigs that night, and then I was just going, oh my God, I fucking lost it. I've lost my mind. I won't be able to sit. I won't be able to write and earn money that way. I won't be able to gig because I'll be having panic attacks on stage, probably piss myself, shit myself. It will go viral. Then I won't be able to ever make eye contact with my son. Not saying that I have a tendency to catastrophize, but, you know. And, you know, when I looked at it on balance, I was just knackered. Do you know what I mean? I was knackered. I was a bit ill. Just be working hard and stuff like that. And then the problem is that pushes it all up to a 9, doesn't it? So I suppose what I'm saying is like when you're really, as a bloke, you know what I mean? When you're really ticking over, you know, the old testosterone's flowing, you're doing all right, you've got a few projects on the go, is sometimes that is the time when that's the most, because you don't want to stop, do you? You don't want to interrogate, oh, how do I feel right now? Because you feel great, because you're working a lot and you're enjoying your work and stuff. But actually, sometimes you don't realise you might be getting, you know, a bit exhausted. So if there's anyone listens, I don't know if I mentioned that, because I think that, you know, people in the public eye, whenever they tell you about mental health wobbles and stuff, is they always tell you from the safety of like, yeah, that was 2 years ago and now I'm fine. Yo, well, fucking good for you, mate. Well done. Thank you for telling me your hero story about how you had mental health problems, but, you know, got it all sorted out and now you're fucking president of fucking Portugal. I didn't really have an out for that. Look, I'm just saying right now, I'm going through it right now. And that's the thing, is I sound in good mood, right? But I'm fucking knackered. And it freaks me out when I'm this tired. And then the anxiety starts. So I guess, you know, I've just got to... And now I'm coming down to this blokey brick wall. A part of me's going, well, you just got to cancel some work, Jeff. You know? Got to cancel some work. You got to relax and recharge. And then my brain's going, don't fucking cancel work. Canceling work's for losers. What are you, weak? So I suppose what I'm... This is incredibly pathetic. What I'm really saying is that I feel like this now, but I'm just going to carry on as I am and sort of hope that this goes away. It might. So we're going to read out as ever. Now, I appealed on the last podcast for some 5-star reviews because I felt I was getting a slew of 4-star reviews. And in a moment of extreme modesty, I decided that wasn't enough. I decided that. I got to say, props to this person, a guy called Proper Gross, who responded to my desperate need for 5 stars by saying, 4 stars podcast all day long. This is the most 4-star podcast ever. Great work from Jeff, Mr. 4-star Norcott. You know what? If you're gonna troll me, that is the fucking way to do it. That was funny. You're right. I shouldn't be begging, but I did. And you know what, Proper Gross? Some people are nice. And some people did write 5-star podcast. No, a fucking 6-star podcast from Chilton chap. Can't remember where the Chilterns is. Is it in the West Country? Is it where? Fuck it. The West Country, right? Great comedy. Laugh out loud. Embarrassingly loud chat with the guests. Laugh out loud. Hang on. Great comedy. Laugh out loud. Embarrassingly loud chat. Look, okay. I don't want to do like West Country stereotypes here, but straight away, I think you missed a bit of school. And this is really bad. No, thank you, Chilton Chap, for your 6 stars. And a witty and challenging, gently challenging, thought-provoking approach to some of today's big, brackets, and little issues. You saying I've got a small cock? Almost wet myself on the tube listening to banter with Ramesh Rabganathan. Do you know what, like, I've seen a lot of and heard a lot of Ramesh misspellings and mispronunciations. That one, you just pulled that out of nowhere. That is, I'm going to let him know about that one. That's creative. You are breaking new territory in getting Ramesh's name wrong. But thank you for that, chill chap. And yeah, 6 stars, that's probably, I'd agree. I think it probably is a 6-star show. Unless you mean by that 6 out of 10, in which case we might have a fucking issue. But listen, mate, thank you for reviewing. Thank you for everybody that's buying tour tickets. That's ticking over nicely. Don't forget to buy Edinburgh tickets if you're going to be at the Fringe. And also, Simon Evans is going to be up for the full run, doing a proper show, not just his work in progress shit. And that, if you like your comedy thoughtful and funny and thought-provoking and a real laugh, then that would be a great show to check out. Thank you very much for listening. Subscribe, rate it, tell your friends. Have a good one.
What most people think.